Welcome, listeners, to the second series of the Student Accommodation Podcast, brought to you by City Room Rentals, a leading student housing platform and agency partner. I'm Nick Findlay, and on today's episode, we're going to change up the format slightly to bring you a two-part bite-sized interviews with today's guest to keep the information current on the investment landscape within the sector. Thank you to today's sponsors, Y-First, the European Wi-Fi leader with over 17 years of experience and over 1,900 residences deployed across Europe. Today on the show, we'll be focusing on the investment within the sector and aim to get an overview of the current activity in the market. To assist with this, I'm delighted to welcome on the podcast today a leading advisor within the sector. James Pullen is an equity partner at Knight Frank and heads up the Knight Frank student property team. James has over 17 years of experience in the student property sector and has undertaken market-leading transactions and valuations for the sector's most influential investors, developers, and operators. James's team values in excess of £12 billion in purpose-built student accommodation and undertakes transactions with committed funds in excess of £2 billion annually. So, without further ado, we're delighted to welcome James onto the podcast today. Welcome on the show, James, and thanks for coming on to share your expertise with us today.
Hi there, Nick. Good to be here. Thank you for that.
No problem at all. Well, James, perhaps we could just dive straight in and look perhaps at the political landscape at present, as much as we perhaps would like to avoid it. There's a lot of uncertainty around Brexit, and business in general is obviously being impacted. What are your observations on the impact of Brexit, and is there any evidence that our investors are being put off in the sector?
Well, at the point of recording, we've still literally no idea whether we will or won't Brexit and what the landscape's going to be like, even over the next 2 months, let alone the next 2 years. But there are some certainties out there which I think investors like. And purpose-built student accommodation is lucky in that it literally sits between higher education, which the UK has been exceptionally good at, not just for tens or even a few hundred years, it's been literally good at higher education for over 1,000 years. And additionally, it sits between, on the other side, a structural shortfall of residential. We just don't have enough housing in the UK, let alone for students, but for everybody across the UK. So it sits in a particularly attractive niche for overseas investors. And the one observation we can see that the Brexit uncertainty has caused is that the fall in the value of sterling. So right now, the UK has never looked better value from a sterling perspective. And there are two implications of that. One is that the international students themselves are turning up in their droves to the UK. And we will see this September more international students than the UK has ever seen before. And on another impact is that the investors are looking across and looking at the UK and saying it's a buy opportunity. Arguably, it's a once-in-a-lifetime buy opportunity. We're getting close. We've been at parity with the euro for some time. We're getting increasingly close to parity with the dollar. And it's the combined impact is very much seen as a buying opportunity.
Okay, fantastic. And for your perspective at Knight Frank then, and your exposure, what are your thoughts on the money flow within the sector? Where is it coming from, perhaps source countries, types of funders, etc.? If you could give us your take on that.
So it's absolutely all about the international investors for the reasons we've just outlined. Two groups, I suppose. One, it's the Singaporean oblique Far East Asian investors, particularly now Hong Kong investors look like they're going to be making a significant play for unfortunate reasons domestically for them, but the UK looks good value. And then you combine that with the US private equity funds that are coming over again for similar reasons in terms of sterling, but also perceiving the opportunity. And then on top of all of that, you have another element to the investment sphere, which is that student accommodation forms part of the residential investment sector. And we have institutions looking to invest in the lifetime journey that young people have from education through to employment, through ultimately through to retirement with purpose-built student accommodation, co-living, PRS, and then through to senior living. And that has really started to become a driving feature of the market, is investors who are now wanting to invest in more than one asset class within the residential investment sector. So although uncertain times and although it has to be said, transactions are taking longer to do than they did before. They're more difficult to get through. The reality is that the investor landscape is attractive. We've got a good range of investors, and student accommodation remains liquid at prices substantially the same as they were 6 months ago or even 12 months ago.
Very encouraging. And James, we chatted briefly offline about the sort of globalization of the sector. Perhaps you could touch upon and give listeners your thoughts about why this is relevant, you know, perhaps from a funding debt perspective and also the future of higher education.
Yes, the globalization of the sector really is extraordinary in the sense that we've always had international students, so the occupier has been truly global. But now we're seeing the development of both funders at an equity level and at a debt level being truly international. And then on top of that, you've got the development of global brands and platforms that are wanting to market themselves, not just in the jurisdiction that they set out their development platform from, but now truly globally, so that they can capture students who perhaps are studying for a year in Sydney and then want to study for a year in London as well. And they want an understanding of a similar brand, very much in line with, I suppose, the hotel brands. So there's that layer to it, but there's also then on top of that, there is the development for investors. It's all about economies of scale, and the more stock you own, the more the economies of scale really starts to make the investment attractive, and that has a global play as well. I mean, I suppose it's worth noting that Unite, subject to the Monopolies and Mergers Commission, or whatever they're called these days, authorizing it, have recently acquired the Liberty platform and portfolio. And that is very much seen as an economy of scale driven acquisition. It makes an awful lot of sense for Unite to have made that acquisition. But it shows how important delivering scale is in terms of delivering investment returns.
And do you see an appetite for more of the M&A there, James, in terms of those types of transactions? That was obviously a huge one, but do you see that perhaps more activity of a similar nature in the future? Without going into too much depth, I'm sure you'll have confidential information, but anything of thoughts on that?
Well, the next trend, I suppose, is seeing national portfolios, and particularly I suppose we're seeing national portfolios in Australia and mainland Europe that will now be bought into global platforms for that economy scale piece. So yes, I think that'll be probably a defining feature of the next 24 months.
There's a couple of big portfolios on sale in Australia as well, I believe. So it's an interesting market. So James, just to slightly change the question here, could I get your thoughts really on the impact of Grenfell and sort of cladding issues and how they've impacted the sector, perhaps from a build, design and lending perspective, if I may?
I suppose firstly to say the sector has responded, I think, in a very reassuring way. It's done far more than has been asked, as is appropriate, to respond to the tragedy. There have been a number of buildings that have been taken out of commission, stripped, reclad, and being put back onto the occupational market. But it's, I suppose, two things to say. One is that this issue is now far more than just about the cladding. It's also about fire health safety issues generally, and particularly fire stopping issues, and has probably got a long way to go in terms of the market's understanding of the importance of the issue. And certainly on the second point, I suppose, from a lender perspective, I think we've yet to see lenders really grapple with the importance of fire health and safety issues in respect of their lending criteria. And that is going to change when they really get hold of it and understand it. I think it will change the landscape of the market a little bit, because at the moment, transacting property with any fire health safety issue attached to it is really, really difficult. The problem has to be unpicked, it has to be paid for, all before the deal will go through, whereas often we're seeing the lending market perhaps being far less pernickety about the issues that are at hand and what needs to be done to address them. So as that plays forward, I think we'll see that sort of levelling up of the market between whether it makes sense for an owner to refinance or transact.
Okay, some complex issues there. Well, that's a good take. Thanks for that, James. If I may, if I could just circle back, I was just touching upon the point on globalisation that you referred to. I think I picked up from some really interesting stats from your research, and I think one of them was particularly noteworthy, was that there was around about a 33% year-on-year rise in prospective Chinese students from around about 11,000. Just under 12,000 up to around about 16,000. Now, it followed an increase of around about 20% for the previous year. And more interestingly, it brings the Chinese applicant numbers to nearly the same level as those for Wales and Northern Ireland. So with that sort of globalisation piece, what are your thoughts on the rise of China in the sort of higher education sector? And potentially, what are you advising investors and operators currently?
So I suppose investors are looking at it from a risk perspective. They're looking at the risks associated with Brexit and any potential fall in the 7-8% percentage of students that come from mainland Europe. There are some, it's likely that mainland European students will have to increase their tuition fees from roughly 9 to roughly £18,000 per year. So that will have a drag effect on the number of European students. I don't think it'd be huge, but it would have an impact. Meanwhile, at the same time, we've got Chinese students and other international students generally looking at the value of sterling and absolutely coming to the UK in their droves. I mean, last year, I think we saw 17% rise in Chinese students. This year, it's going to be more like 25%. That's unsustainable, obviously, as a growth rate, but as a trend that generally the UK is attracting more international students, and particularly the Chinese. I think there is a thought that the Chinese students particularly are not attracted to the US at the moment, even though that's a English language location for political reasons. It's about, I suppose, diversity and spreading risk and making sure that the UK isn't exposed to too high a level of recruitment from any one jurisdiction, and that where some may go up, others go down at any one point in time.
And do you feel, what sort of level do you feel we're at the moment in terms of reliance on that particular market? You know, from a university perspective, are we relying perhaps too heavily on those for tuition fees? Are we over-leveraged slightly on that as a source country? Or are we about right?
If you look at the macro stats from OECD, we're on a 10-year path of significantly increasing international students. So I think it's on trend with that. The other piece is that the UK has been relatively hostile to international students. I think particularly it's perceived Indian subcontinent students have had a really difficult time getting visas at the point they want them. And the message, I think, from the UK hasn't been as welcoming as it should be. So, no, I'm not concerned that there's been too much too quickly from Chinese students. What we'll actually see is perhaps a levelling up from other geographic locations. And I think all the political signs are, I mean, whether Boris Johnson will get the opportunity to stay in power much longer, who knows? But he has historically been positive about, for instance, removing international students from immigration figures. I don't think Boris Johnson's is likely to implement the Augur review in majority. I don't think he's likely to reduce domestic student tuition fees. So I think there are a number of things that he's doing that will, if given the opportunity, will actually be relatively positive for the higher education sector, whatever your broader views on him.
Well, on the India, you know, point you've made there, I think your UK student housing update sort of highlighted that demand overall for international students remains strong despite uncertainty, while the sort of changing demographic trends should strengthen domestic demand. But it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on, you know, potential immigration changes and, you know, the potential impact on overseas students.
Well, the changes we're likely to see are around allowing qualified students who've been successful in obtaining degrees in the UK to stay on and work in the UK for longer, and also students, registered students who are studying in the UK to actually undertake more part-time work. And just on that point, one of the reasons overseas students come to the UK is to learn English and to understand the UK culture. But I think the restriction at the moment is 8 hours part-time work, which is relatively harsh. And I think it's likely that that's going to be relaxed, which will make UK more attractive. And then on the piece around staying after graduating, again, it looks like the political drums are saying that why on earth are we restricting these highly qualified young students, post-students coming out and not staying in the UK for a couple of years to both support the economy and be very much part of the UK scene. So I think that's, the noises seem very positive coming out that we will, the message we're sending internationally is much more welcoming than it has been before, which arguably, I suppose, is in contrast to the wider immigration pitch and story, where it looks likely that irrespective of the political colour in government, the noises will all be about reducing immigration and being less welcoming to people who want to come over more, on a more permanent basis.
As you say, probably still work to be done, but the rhetoric is getting slightly more positive, so it'll be nice to see how that plays out to make it more welcoming. We're going to take a short ad break now to thank our sponsors, Why First, and we'll be back with James very shortly. This series of the Student Accommodation Podcast is sponsored by Why First, a historical provider of Wi-Fi managed services for student accommodations. Regardless of whether you're in the hospitality, senior, or student housing industry, you know that a great Wi-Fi connection is a fundamental need for your customers. Why First is a leader in managed Wi-Fi services for PBSA, with 17 years of experience and over 1,900 residences deployed across Europe. Trust the European Wi-Fi leader for your next turnkey solution, contacting them on whyfirst.com/EN. Okay, we're back. James, if I may, I would just like to switch up some of the questioning and perhaps get your take on the market and the general shift away from studio flats to en-suites. What do you think has been the main contributing factors towards this in the market, you know, from your observations?
Well, I suppose, first of all, I might take some issue with the question. I mean, every core market in the UK has room for studio-only schemes. They need to be the premium product in the premium location. And generally, we see they are trading well and they're attractive to students that are, elect to go there because it's their choice to take that accommodation. And across the UK, let's not forget that studio rents in, I think, every single market in the UK are higher than the rent for a cluster flat bedroom, ensuite bedroom in a similar location. So there is a level of controversy about studio schemes. There is some perceived wisdom that new development should have less than 25% of the scheme in studios, which I think for schemes of, say, 400, typical institutional lot size, 400 beds, is probably right. That isn't to say there isn't space for studio schemes and for selective development of 100-bed studio schemes, but it's unlikely we're going to see the development of, say, 400-bed studio schemes targeted at the institutional investor, because that is very clearly not what they're targeting to get, with the potential exception of London, where institutional investors are happy to get any stock they can in London because of the dynamics of the market, including all studio schemes of small or large size.
Okay. And do you see that across, in terms of that then, James, is it varying across markets in terms of the studios? So, you know, for some markets are doing particularly well, some markets they may be struggling because of price points. So is it really down to that sort of micro city by city analysis when you're looking at that?
Well, if you take London as a good example, London has over 300,000 students and a pipeline that is now drifting below 5,000 new beds being delivered each year. So for the size of the market, the pipeline is absolutely tiny, and it's likely to get reduced further because of the nature of the London plan now requiring that all new schemes effectively have university sponsorship and no universities. Oh, I think it's highly unlikely we're going to see universities sponsoring studio-only schemes in London. So there's a pipeline implication there. That said, if you look at the Scape product in London, which is largely studio-driven, the product is excellent. It's fully let. Investors are very happy with it. And the occupants think it's a fantastic product. So I think we need to be really careful about branding studios bad, clusters good. It's simply more complicated than that.
Okay. Fair enough. That's a nice take on that, James. Do you have any other notable observations about, you know, design and build changes perhaps you're witnessing in the sector, perhaps in recent times or, you know, coming up in the future?
Well, I don't know if they're notable, but certainly value for money has been a big driver for the market, which sort of links to your studio question, I suppose. So absolutely, we're going to see a focus on whether the price point at which schemes are being delivered is right, and making sure that there is a good menu of product and that the price point is, it has to be very carefully assessed, because development viability at the moment with the level of construction cost is difficult to achieve in most regional markets today unless you build high-end products. So it's going to be difficult for developers to get that balance right. I think one other point I would observe, and we've seen it from the US, is that the designing in of a clubhouse concept into schemes. So where schemes have a residence clubhouse, not just a physical form of the clubhouse, but also a theme that runs through the marketing and branding of the scheme, residents feel a much better sense of identity with the scheme. I think they have a better sense of community and a sense of belonging. And that ultimately feeds through to rents. So the development of the clubhouse concept, I think, will start to roll out with new schemes across the UK as developers and investors recognise that it's great for customer satisfaction, it's great for occupancy, and ultimately it's good for rental demand as well.
And James, on that point there on the rental side of things, what's your take on sort of some of the rent caps that are being introduced in markets? You know, if we take Ireland probably as the most recent example, is that a challenge that operators and investors have to take into account? And what have you been your general sort of findings from that?
We've seen rent caps introduced in Ireland. We've seen rent caps coming into the US market. And we've certainly heard an awful lot of discussion about whether rent caps will come into the UK market, together with quite a lot of discussion about whether general short-hold tenancy tenants in the wider market should be allowed to roll on their tenancy, and that the landlord shouldn't be able to restrict the length of their tenancy. Now, the piece about the rental growth, as long as rental growth is capped to RPI, say, plus one, well, that in all sorts of ways aligns with the institutional investors' expectations of where rental growth will be for their schemes, which will fundamentally align to RPI. So I think if their rental growth is capped at, say, RPI plus one, I really see it having very limited impact on investment demand, save for situations where the rent, for whatever reason, has got out of kilter with the real requirements of the market. Now, just coming to that point about length of tenancies, in the wider market for people in co-living and PRS schemes, having security of tenure may well be important. If you've got a family and you're on an AST, you want to know that you can stay in that building without the landlord being able to evict you with 1 month's notice at any point in the next 12 years. It's not right or reasonable. So yes, legislation will catch up with that, and I think we'd all understand it. But in the student market, there are very good reasons why the student market is different to the wider market. And I know that BPF, British Property Federation, are inviting representations on it, and it's probably important for the sector to do that. It's not a requirement for a student to have the right to stay on at a purpose-built student accommodation building, and it definitely affects how the schemes can be marketed to the next year students if there's no clarity about whether that tenant will stay on or how long they will stay on for. So there's a piece there that needs unpicking, but fundamentally, is it a problem that legislation will start to protect the rights of tenants? No, it isn't, because the sector is well run, it's institutionally run, and by and large, to a very high extent, looks after its tenant, and it will not be frightened of legislation that is fair and reasonable.
And talking there about, you've just touched on there, James, on tenancy lengths, specifically within PBSA, what are your thoughts on sort of how the sector has adapted in recent years from, you know, having core long-term tenancies, say, depending on the market, 43 weeks or 51 weeks, to now mixing it up with a variety of different tenancy lengths, from shorter semester stays to, you know, specifically Student Roost, actually a good example, where they have a slider and the students can actually bespoke and choose their tenancy. How has that impacted, do you think, from a valuation point of view or forecasting point of view? Has it had a big impact on the sector?
I suppose, ironically, the student sector is one of the few sectors where it's in the tenant's interest they can have shorter tenancies rather than longer. Yes, Student Roost are a good example. I think they offer anywhere between 42 weeks and I think up to 56 weeks for students who want to stay on for both summers and their term time. How does that flexibility affect investment demand? Well, increasingly we're seeing a move, I think, across all markets that student tenancies are starting to move to be longer rather than shorter. So moving from 42 weeks through to 48 and 51.
just to finish up with these quick fire questions, obviously student property now fits within a residential investment umbrella. You know, investors are seeking to acquire assets within, you know, the student property, private rental and senior living sectors. So could you perhaps explain to our listeners how institutional investors' appetite has changed in recent years, and also what the future might hold, just to finish this up?
We had an investor survey which we undertook only a few months ago, where we asked investors in the residential investment arena, firstly, how many of the sectors they owned and controlled in at the moment, as in, are they just specialists in either purpose-built student accommodation or co-living or PRS or senior? And then secondly, as a follow-up to that, what were their intentions over the next 5 years? And that identified that well under half of the respondents had more exposure to more than one sector today, but well over half of the respondents, in fact, nearly 80%, said that within 5 years they want to be a pan-residential investment specialist, an investor in education, employment and retirement in terms of rental product. So we're going to see that residential investment, which previously was seen as somewhat niche asset class, I think will now be seen as one of the big four, along with retail, office and investment, residential investment, and that there will be a significant trend of the institutional investors wanting to get hold of platforms in more than just either student or co-living or senior living.
Brilliant.
So I think it's exciting times in that sense. It's arguably the only property sector where there is significant and sustainable growth that could be forecast over 5 or even 15 years. The institutions have now found themselves product, and there is a shortfall in the UK of homes for people, and this is a sector that can meet that demand.
Great. I hope everyone's enjoyed, from a listener perspective, this new format. I think it's been really, you know, refreshing to get James's overview on the sector, and, you know, we'd love to have him back on early in the new year to perhaps give us an update on the research within the market. James, thank you for, you know, coming on to share your expertise with us. If any of our listeners would like to contact you or Knight Frank, how's best to go about that?
Well, we are active on social media, email, or even on the good old telephone. If we help in any way, let us know.
Perfect. Okay. Well, I'd like to extend our thanks to today's listeners again for tuning in. We do hope you'll join us for the next instalment. This series of the Student Accommodation Podcast is sponsored by YFirst, a historical provider of Wi-Fi managed services for student accommodations. Regardless of whether you're in the hospitality, senior or student housing industry, you know that a great Wi-Fi connection is a fundamental need for your customers. Trust the European Wi-Fi leader for your next turnkey solution, contacting them on yfirst.com/en.